Our exploration this morning will be an experiential one. We're going to practice in the way of Sufism. And the subject is Sufi meditation. The sources of the tradition of meditation in Sufism are many. Meditation was practiced by the Hunafa, the Hanifs of ancient Arabia, in the days before the advent of Islam. And in fact, the present month, according to the lunar calendar, the month of Ramadan, was the month that was especially consecrated to a practice that was called Tahannuth, which meant to go into seclusion, into retreat. And there was a special mountain called Jabal Nur, the mountain of light, where people traditionally secluded themselves during this course of this month, particularly at the end of the month, and practiced certain disciplines of meditation. These Hunafa were monotheists. They believed in the unity of being. They felt kinship with Christians and Jews, but they did not define their religion dogmatically. And it was in this community that Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam went and underwent retreat. And in the course of these periods of seclusion, a process of clarification occurred, ultimately culminating in the revelation that he experienced. And so the earliest source of meditation in Sufism is this ancient desert tradition. And then with the advent of Islam, with the revelation that came to Muhammad, there was a powerful new impulse, and he communicated the mystical essence of that impulse to his closest companions, particularly to Hazrat Ali, to Hazrat Abu Bakr, and to Hazrat Fatima, his daughter. And through them, lineages of transmission were initiated, lineages of transmission that have subsequently been passed down over the generations in unbroken succession, from heart to heart, never contained in books, never able to be summarized or synthesized in an intellectual system, always transmitted as a quality of presence that could only be passed on by direct contact from heart to heart. And these lineages have continued in unbroken succession over the ages. In this way, certain spiritual practices, such as the dhikrullah, the remembrance of God, have been practiced just as they have been preserved over centuries and are given from heart to heart. But as the Sufi tradition progressed, its repertoire expanded, and the followers of the Prophet Muhammad, as they ventured out into further lands, encountered the Desert Fathers, and there was a very profound interchange of ideas and of methods that occurred there. And at the same time, the Sufis were absorbing the Israiliyat, the traditions of the rabbis. And as Sufism progressed east, there was an encounter with the Buddhist tradition in Khorasan. Ibrahim Adham Balkhi was one of the great early Sufis who was originally a king, the king of Balkh, who gave up his throne. And his story echoes the story of the Buddha, who was born into wealth and splendor and power, but sacrificed it to his ideal. Yesterday I read some of the Persian poetry that invokes the beautiful idol, and the word for idol is but. That word comes from Buddha, because the Sufis of Khorasan encountered the Buddhist tradition and venerated the figures of the Buddhas as epiphanies, as tajalliyat of the divine beauty. And then in India, as the Sufis made their way, they came into contact with the traditions of the yogis, particularly the Nathpanti tradition of yoga, traced to Gorakhnath. And in the Khanka of a predecessor of this line, Baba Farid Ganji Shakar, there were repeated conversations between the yogis and the Sufis on matters of spiritual practice. And they shared many things in common, but the Sufis continued to develop their own method, parallel to the method of yoga, informed by yoga, but never equivalent to the system in yoga. There's certain distinct differences in the system that was developed in Sufism. And in the course of this session, we will touch upon some of those distinctions. The primary distinction being the emphasis on the heart, which brings in a second axis, you might say, the axis of renunciatory traditions is primarily the vertical axis. To this, the Sufi tradition contributes the complementary horizontal tradition, forming as the basis of the human physiology, the cross of light that reaches upward but also outward. And so we say in our invocation, toward the one united with all. Other methods were learned from animals. One of the very great early Sufis was Hazrat Shibli. And he was, in his time, considered a madman. No one understood him. But he was seen in states of meditation. And afterward, people would sometimes come to him and say, "Where did you learn to meditate as you're doing? It was unheard of." And he explained, "I learned by watching a cat in front of a mouse hole. I saw the precision of awareness, the silence, the stillness, and I thought, I consider myself a superior species, a human being, and yet if I cannot do what a cat can do, then I have no reason to hold myself in such pride." So he decided to learn from the cat, and that is how he learned muraqaba. So when we speak about meditation, we're really speaking about several different kinds of practices. There is, first of all, concentration. That is what Shibli learned from the cat. Then there is contemplation. Then there is meditation. And finally, there is realization. Four stages. The first stage is to learn to still the body, to silence the tongue, to let the thoughts begin to resolve themselves into a steady singular focus. This is something that we are not taught in school. By acculturation, we are restless. Even the kinds of media that we use are ones that overstimulate us, confront us with a barrage of constant visual stimulation. In medieval times, our ancestors learned the art of memory, which involved very specific, detailed exercises for recalling information, for example, visualizing a mansion with many rooms. And if you want to memorize a list of items, you would place one item in each room of the mansion. And then when you go to recall the list, you would walk in your mind through the mansion, through the rooms, seeing what is there. These are practices that are inherent in the Western tradition that belong to this theme of concentration. But the essence of concentration is what is called in Sanskrit ekagrata, single-pointed awareness. And that is the foundation of meditation. Often on the path, a seeker will be excited by the prospect of fantastic visualizations, but not having first mastered the ability to simply keep the body still, to feel proprioceptively the inner motion, and to enter into the silence without having first learned that, nothing else can truly be accomplished. So that is the first stage. But then there's a second stage, contemplation, which is not just holding a single image or a single point in the mind, but with the same quality of keen awareness, relaxation, opening up a thought, an idea, reaching into its inner recesses, no longer as we typically do, satisfying ourselves with the superficial surface of ideas, skipping from thought to thought, but rather now taking a thought, taking a feeling, and going deeper and deeper, stripping away veil after veil to get to the essence. Because according to the Sufi view, although relatively speaking it is true to say that this world of shifting impressions is a kind of a phantasmagoria, a kind of illusion, and yet it is also true that the world is the manifestation of reality. And thus, everything that reveals itself here, by ta'wil, by going back to its essence, is found to be founded in reality. And even every emotion, every habit, even our destructive habits, are found to have at their root a divine impulse. So there's nothing to be escaped from, nothing to run away from. It's just like what you might experience in a dream. If you have recurring nightmares, you'll see that you're confronted with a frightening image. And if you turn and run, you will be pursued. But if you look straight on and approach the image, It transforms and reveals there's something behind the mask. This is the way with all phenomenon. To go into the depth is to discover the divine impulse that underlies all things. Nothing is excluded. Nothing is unworthy. At the heart of every need, hope, desire is the divine will. So the next stage of this continuum of meditation is contemplation, going into the depths of an idea. And then one reaches the third stage, which is beyond ideas, which is meditation itself. And this means experiencing a quality of mind that is of the nature of presence. There are two qualities of mind. There is representational thought and presential thought. Representational thought means thinking in concepts, in images, making correspondences. In other words, I understand the world by the immediacy of images that occur within my mind. So I posit that there is an object outside of which I make an internal representation. When we look around the room just now, we might think that we're looking out on the world. But where is this all occurring? It is occurring within the mind. The signals transmitted on the waves of photons impinging on the eye produce impressions, and those impressions are projected in the theater of the mind, producing this scene. But it is taking place within. And so much of our knowledge of the world is secondhand. But that cannot be the only mode of knowledge. Because if we only knew secondhand, how would we ever know? If we make an image of reality, how do we know the image? Do we make another image of the image and an image of the image? No, there must be an act of immediate awareness. There must be, if there is knowledge by representation, there must also be such a thing as presence, because representation means representing, making present again. But what does it mean to be present in the first place? How does one know in this essential mode? If you introduce yourself, you say, I am so-and-so. So-and-so is the representation, your self-image, who you take yourself to be, your identity, which is based in large part on whom you think other people take you to be. But that sentence has two parts. I am so-and-so. So-and-so is the self-image. But who is the I? You are saying that I equals so-and-so. But who is the I to begin with? We couldn't identify so-and-so as ourselves unless we knew ourselves in some prior and essential way. And that essential self-knowledge has nothing to do with representation, nothing to do with conjecture or opinion. It never changes. Your persona changes, but the sense of I-ness, the sheer sense of beingness, that never changes. That is sheer luminous presence. It is a quality of light. Physical light has a certain quality. Physical light is light that reveals all things, that makes things apparent. And nothing can make physical light more apparent than it already is. So that is the definition of light. Things are not apparent in themselves. It's light that makes them apparent. And nothing can make light more apparent than it already is. But then there's another kind of light. That is a kind of light that not only makes things apparent, and not only is apparent itself, but which makes itself apparent to itself. A light which makes itself apparent to itself. That is the I. When we say, I am so and so, it is the light that makes itself apparent to itself. And its own self-apparency is just its self-awareness. It contains nothing. Its substance is nothing but its own luminous self-knowledge. That is all that it is. Its perpetual act of self-witnessing. So when we speak of meditation, we're speaking of the transit from representational knowledge to that innate presential knowledge, the knowledge of I-ness. It has no truth value, true or false. It is not right or wrong. It does not have any qualities or description. It simply is. And then there's one further stage in this continuum. So we went from concentration to contemplation, and now contemplation to meditation, and finally meditation to realization. Realization means retaining this essential, transcendent awareness of the eternity of one's being, the luminous self-reflexive quality that you are now as you always were and ever will be. Retaining this awareness, but reopening the senses, reopening channels of communication, returning to work and to all of the complexities and nuances of life as an embodied person. But now fully immersed continually in the conviction of the luminous I that is now as it always was and ever will be. So there are stages of progression on this path. And we will be sharing in some of the methods that are traditionally employed for the cultivation of these stages of awakening. I mentioned that the Sufis had an encounter with the followers of Gorakhnath in India. And there was a deep interchange of ideas. They were coming from completely different cultural worlds. The Sufis coming from the Beni Israeli Semitic tradition, albeit a tradition that was infused by the Hellenistic heritage of pre-Socratics, Empedocles and Parmenides, and also of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and the Neoplatonists. And the yogis were coming from the tradition of the Vedas and the Upanishads. And so there was a tremendous interchange between two great world civilizations that occurred in this way. It was described by the Mughal prince Dara Shikoh as a Majmu' al-Bahrain, merging of two oceans. And he could feel the privilege of standing like Moses and Khizr at that place of the merging of the two oceans. And in our time, we have a privilege which represents the continuation of these cultural contacts. We stand, you might say, at the merging point of many oceans. And so as these traditions came together, they found that they had very different vocabularies. And Prince Darashaku was one who tried to be an interlocutor between these languages. He translated from Sanskrit into Arabic. But there were certain things that they had in common in their lexicons. And one of the principles that they had in common was the law of the elements. The law of earth, water, fire, and air. It came in the Sufi tradition originally through Empedocles. And in the tradition of the yogis, it is already present in the Vedas. Now, this law is a profoundly transformative spiritual heritage, but it is one that we, as postmodern people, post-industrial Western people, do not immediately identify with, because when we think of the elements, we tend to think of the periodic table. And if we think of earth, water, fire, and air, we think of perhaps a quaint but outdated idea. However, it is important to remember that the reality that earth, water, air, and fire describe has not been displaced by the periodic table, because it never did refer to molecular configurations. Rather, it refers to archetypes that link up the microcosm to the macrocosm, channels of sympathy between self and cosmos, angels. And we never, when we dream, we never dream of nitrogen. We never dream of helium, but we do dream of earth. We dream of water, fire, air. These are primal modes of awareness that speak directly to the deeper levels of the psyche. And this continuum of elements represents a spectrum of planes of existence that span between our most manifest and individualized dimension and that dimension of ourselves which is most transcendent and eternal. Between the hard contours of our physical personhood and the universality and infinity of our ultimate being, there are degrees of personhood. And these degrees are represented by the elements. So the first element, the element of earth, is very much suggestive of embodiment in its most dense form. Now, we tend to think that we live in a materialistic culture and that what we need is less materialism and more spirituality. But can we say that we are truly materialistic? What does it mean to be materialistic? To identify with matter, to have a sensitivity to matter? Do we have this? Have we achieved this? To be materialistic in the true sense would be to be aware as one walks of the pressure of the ground as it presses against the soles of one's feet, holding one by the force of eshq, the force of love that holds us on this planet, which according to the Sufis is a species of divine attraction. The same love that moves the stars in their courses, the planets in their revolutions, the same gravitational force that holds us gently but firmly to the earth, is the divine desire. To feel it in the soles of one's feet is to feel God's love immediately. And that is materialism. That is a true materialism. So before we imagine that our spiritual progress requires us to disidentify our body, it would be significant first to understand what it would mean to truly identify with our body, to be awake in our body. And then one would see that the barrier is not the body itself, it's our representation of the body. It's the fetish that we make of the body. But to experience the body directly is to rediscover life. Most often we are so preoccupied with rushing here and there, attending to what is urgent at the expense of what is important. And in doing so, we rarely listen within and feel the rhythms that occur within our very flesh. And if we did, we would have a very different sense of ourselves. No longer would our body be that which differentiates us, which separates us, but we would see that in our very embodiment, we are intimately bound up in the cosmos. I always wonder what human civilization would look like if physiologically we were different in some minor ways. For example, if, like a jellyfish, instead of having skin that is opaque, we would have skin that is transparent. So much of how we identify ourselves depends on our assumptions based on looking with our eyes from outside. What if we walked through life with transparent skin? You would see all the things that are going on inside as you're having lunch, taking in the environment, watching how that which you consume is broken up and becomes new flesh in you, and the old cells are released. How every day the body is just like a vortex in the ocean of matter, taking in new life, reforming itself, so that in the space of just 5 years, the whole of your matter has been recycled. So you are, in the space of 5 years, physically speaking, a completely different person. But we so much fetishize our representation of the body, we think that we are this monolith, this mass of matter. This matter is not ours. It is shared, it is circulating. The same flesh that makes up your hand has occupied the bodies of innumerable birds, worms, trees, heroes of old, fish in the sea. This very flesh is the same substance that is continuously transmuting itself. So the first stage in this sequence is identifying with earth and rediscovering the body from a new perspective, realizing that this body is kindred to all creatures, that its very morphology summarizes the history of existence on this planet, and not a single organism has ever lived who does not somehow continue to live in the form that we have taken. This body is the epitome of the cosmos heretofore, the summation of what has been. And so we begin in this way, appreciating the body, appreciating this clay as a clay that has been molded for eons, becoming more supple, more intelligent, more conducive to the light of the divine spirit, of the will that is working within. What a mystery it is, what a uncanny awakening it is to feel oneself here and now, occupying these bodies, feeling oneself simultaneously present within the flesh, and yet knowing that the flesh is only a temporary accretion, and that that which knows itself within this flesh transcends it. It's startling when one experiences this strangeness directly. And then we come to the element of water. The liquid, fluid dimension of our being. And beyond this, the element of fire. At each stage, we are relaxing our attachment to form and entering into a finer, subtler dimension of embodiment. Beyond fire is air, the gaseous state. And then beyond the gaseous state is ether, the all-pervading element that is changeless and ineffable. So when the Sufis met the yogis, they had this language in common. They could speak about the elements, knowing that they were speaking about sacred dimensions of the divine as manifest in the world, that they were speaking of archangels, Mikael, the angel of the earth, Israfil, the angel of water, Azrael, the angel of fire, and Jibrail, the angel of the air. That matter is not dead. Matter is not inanimate, as positivist science asserts, an assertion that has led to such confusion and despair in our own civilization. Matter is not inanimate because inanimate means soulless. And each of these levels of manifestation is fully ensouled, fully representative of the divine reality in all of its sacrality. and each dimension is equally necessary in its particular sphere, equally necessary to the fulfillment of God's purpose. And so when we work with the elements, we work not to escape the bondage of matter, but to feel the full continuum of our being, from the most crystallized to the most essential, and to learn to move fluidly between these states, because it is the fullness of our own being. So, with this brief introduction, I would like to proceed with some practice together, working with these principles internally on the breath. So I, first of all, invite you to take a position that is comfortable, but most importantly, one in which your back is straight. So if you're in a chair, not leaning back against the back of the chair, this belongs to the first level of our work, which is concentration. And in concentration, the straightness of the spine is essential, because to a large degree, our inability to maintain proprioceptive awareness, that is, awareness that is inwardly directed to the inner body, is due to the lack of correct posture, which opens the channels of awareness that are otherwise closed. So we find ourselves conventionally weighed down, burdened down by the heaviness of life, and hunched over, and there are times, of course, to repose, to recline entirely, or to lean back in the chair. But at a moment of concentration such as we are engaging in, it's very important to experience the openness of the breast, which means to be able to let fall back and down all of the heaviness that you've been carrying on your back, and let the spine rise up in a moment of praise and glorification. The posture that is used to facilitate this in prayer is this posture.